All right, we are live. We're back. You're going to see a familiar face tonight, especially if you watch Five Till Midnight, which if you do or if you don't, either way, make sure you're subscribed to our YouTube channel at Five Till Midnight. You can find it pretty easily if you just look it up on YouTube. I'm sure even if you Google it, you could find it. Go subscribe over there because you'll see a familiar face here. And I've been on his show. He's been on this show a couple times. Before we get to that, I kind of want to cover the theme of the show today, and that's going to be the libertarian to dissident right pipeline. And look at that. We already got our Red Hawk in the chat. It's a pipeline. It's a thing. Yeah, it is. I would say probably about the last year, my thoughts on libertarianism haven't necessarily entirely changed, but I think I've started to more so see the idealism in it. And not that that's necessarily entirely a bad thing, but we also kind of have to live in the real world. So and shout out to Red Hawk because he's probably one of these people that's kind of dragged me along, kicking and screaming along the way. But I'm not 100% on board, but I'm definitely more on board than I was, let's say, 6 months to maybe a year ago. So we're going to talk about that, the libertarian to dissident right pipeline, because I think it's a warranted conversation. I think it's something that a lot of people, specifically in libertarian circles, are starting to kind of look at. And the people who aren't looking at it, I kind of have some questions for them. So hopefully they're listening to this and will maybe have answers or maybe think about it themselves. So before we get into the conversation today, make sure to all the links below to figure out everything I got going on, everything my guest has got going on, because he does his own show. And obviously, like I said, is part of Five Till Midnight. And he's pretty awesome on Twitter. Five Till Midnight, Jesus. Fox and Sons Coffee, use code Kyle at checkout. Hit the links below for Tiger Fitness and Deemed Fit to let them know that the Matovic family sent you. And you can get all jacked and juicy and also look damn good while doing it. So I guess without further ado now, let's roll the intro and we'll get into today's conversation about the libertarian to dissident right pipeline.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
And welcoming back to the show, my dear friend, Typo from Biting the Bullet. What's up, man? Your mic's muted.
My bad, dude. I'm doing just fine. How about you, dude?
Good, man. Good. It feels like we were just talking not even 2 days ago. Oh, wait. Yeah.
But, right.
this conversation I kind of wanted to have specifically with you and Sam, but unfortunately, he's been hard at work on the Chase Oliver campaign. And I know that there's just some diseases that get spread around there. So I think he's kind of down with like malaria or something like that. But I'm sure he'll be okay for Monday's show, 5 Till Midnight. But you and I were talking off air, and I think you and I have kind of walked a lot of this, a very, very similar political journey, if you will, over the last year or so. And we kind of talked about this the last time. It was just you and me on here. But I kind of wanted to explore this a little bit further because obviously there's been more development since the last time. And this is just something that I wanted to expand upon, especially because I did a show last week explaining why I'm not an anarchist anymore. So I guess let's start off with, what do you consider the dissident right?
That's pretty hard to define. I think it's not really, in a way, it's not even like really a real thing. It's just kind of like a decentralized group of people online with, I don't really know the best way to describe it, but probably like not liberal, not progressive, not really libertarian. It's like a outside, a lot of it, like a lot of the guys that I run into or at least follow on Twitter, it's more like traditionalist. A lot of it's based in like Christianity or a religion. it's not, but that's not entirely all of them. There's other sections that, you know, it's like monarchist, or you can even maybe even say some maybe fascist, or just like traditional government thinking or political thinking, and like the old way of thinking before the progressive way of thinking took over. But I'm not really exactly sure the best way to describe them, but that's kind of how I see them.
Yeah, I think some of this kind of centers around the idea of it kind of pokes at, let's say, the founding myth of the United States, and more so maybe even like the founding myths, as in plural, where a lot of these guys will say the Enlightenment was a mistake, which basically, if we had to sum up the Enlightenment, I would say that it's basically like these values that we hold in the Constitution are self-evident and they're equal in every single individual person. And that's a really sloppy way to put it, but I think that kind of approximates it, at least good enough for the conversation that we're going to have today. You know, the World War II myth. And I heard somebody once explain it as you kind of come in there through a couple different ways. It's either like the JQ, the Red Pill Sphere, or there was one other one. And I want to say it was probably, I can't remember what exactly it was, but my friend Ryan Stone was on somebody's show, and this guy, if I can remember his name off the top of my head, I would say who it is, but it was actually a good show. And he gave like the three ways that people kind of come into this. And obviously I think one of these pillars would also be like libertarianism, where really I have to give a lot of credit to Pete for this, because I think he was probably one of the biggest ones to kind of pull people towards this direction, if you will. And that kind of came out of what people would dub the post-libertarian moment, if you will. So to me, it kind of seems more like people who are small government, anti-enlightenment conservatives, or even like maybe traditionalists might be a better way to define it. Red Hawk, if I'm still listening, tell me how I'm doing. Is that kind of like your general sense as well?
Yeah, it's definitely older ways of thinking and viewing politics. Like I don't think, like a lot of times they reject the Enlightenment, as you say, pretty much a liberal philosophy like altogether, and that includes libertarianism, so classical liberalism. Everything that comes out of being like the liberal Enlightenment thinking is kind of rejected. And yeah, I think it is like an old way of political thinking that has, for a long time at least, it appeared to me, was completely lost. And these ideas were, I mean, even I admittedly at one point in time thought this was crazy. It's like, we're past this. We've progressed past this, you know, and, you know, but it's really, at least in my opinion, especially with Elon buying Twitter, I think that really exposed people more and more to these ideas more than ever before. And that's why I think some of it's catching on. But yeah, I think I would describe it like traditionalist, based in maybe faith or even racial, things like that, things of that nature in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I think this kind of goes into the whole conversation about libertarianism, and that a lot of people kind of couch it in egalitarian terms. And the first time I had Red Hawk on, him and I kind of talked about this a little bit, and there are some questions that need to be asked when it comes to the idea, the assumptions that libertarianism kind of brings with it. And that's, does everybody want to be free? Can everybody be free? And should everybody be free? And really, the answers to all three of those questions is no, really. Like, a lot of people don't want that. Some people can't. And then, as much as it pains a lot of people, probably that like you and I would consider friends and fellow travelers and people that we would have probably agreed on, you know, vast majorities of things, let's say 2 years ago on, no, people don't want to be free. And I think, you know, this kind of goes back to the whole post-libertarian moment, where you kind of look at the situation in 2020. And I don't think it was as bad as like people outright rejected libertarianism. I think it's just that this approximates that whole elite theory conversation, where the elites at the time had posited that we needed to lock down for safety and all this kind of stuff. And that gave people the general impression that like now is not a safe time for freedom, so to speak. Like, we kind of have to put, what George Bush say back in the day, like capitalism needs to be regulated, or I can't remember the exact term, but basically whenever the housing market crash was happening, they said like, oh, capitalism has failed or something like that. This is kind of, I think that's kind of like a similar situation as to what happened in 2020. So I know that's kind of all over, but yeah, whatever.
Yeah. Well, I think, like, you know, Plato kind of described, like, with the people that don't want to be free, Plato kind of describes people, like, some people, maybe even the majority of people, are just natural slaves, as they just want to be led. They don't want to go against the grain. They don't want to push against the system or anything. They just want to go along, get along. They'll do as they're told, and they're not going to push back against this. And there's probably a lot of truth to that, where people just, they're not going to dig deeper or look at whatever's presented in front of them and whatever authority is telling them what's happening. They're just going to take that at face value and go along with it. Yeah, I think, like, 2020 was kind of an eye opener for a lot of people. And also, I think you can even blame the libertarians themselves. Now, it's not like all libertarians, but there was a significant portion of libertarians that, at the, like, probably the time that libertarians could have shined in a lot of ways was 2020, right? Like the lockdowns, the most encroachment of our time, at least in my lifetime, where they were literally like, you had to, you know, look on TV and see if your governor or mayor or whatever would let you go to a restaurant or let you go to school or whatever. And I think the libertarians, like, in generally completely, almost completely failed that in a lot of ways, especially like the Joe Jorgensen campaigns, like, famous for this. Like, this is a huge critique that people, a lot of people have of them. But, and it also kind of enlightened, showed a lot of people, at least me, that, like, you know, I even said this on, you know, it's so crazy that I said this, but, like, you know, 2 weeks or 3 weeks into the lockdowns on my show, I was like, there's no way this will continue. Like, the American people will not put up with it. Like, I just, and another week went by, another month went by, and then it was 3 months, 4 months. And I was like, oh my God, we're really doing this. We're still wearing masks. You know, and then a year later, like, people were lining up to get the shot. And, like, all the people that I hung out with in, when I lived in Phoenix, Arizona, a lot of them were like, they just got the shot. And, like, they didn't even question it. And it goes to show that, like, I don't think in a lot of ways that people want to be free. They just want to go along, and then you have to. And I think this is, like, actually reflected in history as well. Like, you know, a lot of, like, with our revolution in America or any other, like, revolution that happens, like, it's presented as, like, the people want to overthrow their rulers and throw off the chains of the monarchists, right? The evil kings. But in reality, it's actually a group of elites here that lead that charge. It's not even a popular thing to do at the time. And eventually, over time, they either convince people or just win the revolution, and then they're in charge. So it's not that simple as, like, all these people or most people would go along and with a revolution or whatever. It's that some elite has the will and enough strength to go on and complete the revolution, and then they're just in charge afterwards. It's not like the Bolshevik Revolution is another one. It was like a very small minority population of the Russian population that overthrew the Tsar, and then they're just in charge. And everyone wants their control of the military and the police. Like, once they stamp out all the other resistance, it's pretty much over, and everyone else would just kind of go along with it. And I think that's just true now. I think, like you said, with most people not being free, I think history shows that as well.
Yeah. And I think you're spot on there. And I think it's a little bit of, like, a rosy colored glasses situation when people say or think that it really is, like, a lot of grassroots efforts, but, like, kind of like you said, like, a lot of these situations were generally more powerful people, elites, that were deciding the way that things were going to go. Like, they said, hey, we're going to shove things this way. And Red Hawk said, his comment is, dissident right people all have an issue with the current regime. That's closest you'll get to a unifying axiom. I think when you start to drill down a little bit more, I think it's more so, and once again, Red Hawk would be able to speak about this more authoritatively than I could, but, like, it does seem like to me there's more of a unifying faction, and that's more, it seems to get closer to, like, rejecting the basic Enlightenment values and going back to more, like, traditionally minded stuff. Elite Theory is correct. 2020 put that argument against it to bed. Yeah, for real. But where was I going with that? Yeah, most serious libertarians, the right wing ones, come to libertarianism because they're angry with Republicans. Yet Trump has done more to destroy that party than libertarians have. Yeah, a lot of this stuff does kind of. When you look at 2020, I think it's really hard to argue that libertarians did a good enough job as standing out as like a voice against it. Like, obviously, the people more in our corner were great about it, but like, you also have to ask the question why that wasn't like the face of libertarianism. Like, why weren't, like, I'm not saying like you or I specifically, but like, let's say more so Dave Smith, Tom Woods, Jeff Dice, why weren't they the faces of the libertarian movement and like the libertarian brand? When you and Adam were on last, I think it was me, you, Adam, and Pat McFarlane, and we were kind of talking about the Libertarian Party. I think a lot of people are going to the dissident right now because they kind of see it as like a viable brand to go forward with, because the libertarian brand itself has now become, for it's also become a laughing stock amongst most people, because you look at the way that Joe Jorgensen responded to the Black Lives Matter Black Lives Matter riots. You look at Chase Oliver. I mean, as soon as Chase Oliver got elected, what happened? Everybody dug up every single fucking skeleton in his closet and plastered it everywhere. And every single tweet he gets that he puts out, people just body him in the comments. So I think part of it is a rejection of libertarianism, but I also think it's probably more so a rejection of the libertarian brand, because they realize that like just running on freedom and freedom alone, the people who've represented that over the last at least two election cycles have been complete and total jokes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think also even those names that you named, I don't think a lot of them, like, I think in their own way they do, but they don't reject degeneracy too much. Like, they might, you know, say it or talk about it a little bit, but most of the time, like, they don't necessarily, like with the whole, like, they might call out the LGBTQ. Like, when it got to the trans stuff, I think a lot of libertarian, at least right-wing type libertarians, that was too far. Mm-hmm. But, like, everything kind of before that, they might have not liked it, but they didn't really talk about it that much, you know? Like, they kind of still have this, tendency that, like, people are free to choose whatever they want, and they want to focus on what they would call the most important issues. And there are important, I'm not saying what they talk about is not important issues. Right. Like, I'm not saying that at all. It's very important, like, what those guys focus on, but they didn't see the culture stuff as important. Like, they just didn't see it as important at all. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Dave Smith has even said this, that libertarians need to learn their cultural lesson from the conservatives, because they didn't focus on it. They didn't pay attention to it. They didn't think this stuff mattered in a lot of ways, when this stuff does matter. And I think that also plays into effect why they don't get as much attention, because culture war stuff is what's popular. I mean, that's what, at least if you're a regular person, that's what you deal with. Like, you don't see the wars. Like, the wars might have a major geopolitical effect on you. You know, the taxes, the money printing, what happens over there, like, it might have an effect on you, but it doesn't have a direct effect on you, like the culture stuff that was brewing underneath this whole time that people were kind of blinded to until it was like already in their faces and it's like too late. It's already taken over the institutions and stuff. And I think that actually plays a big role for why libertarians weren't as popular, because they would almost justify these things, not say they're, I wouldn't say justify them, but they were afraid to say that they would outlaw these things or use the state to squash this stuff out and like make it illegal or whatever it is. And I really think that was a really big blind spot for a lot of libertarians, and especially, and well, I in a lot of ways, I think, well, I was a kid of public school and then I went to college. So, you know, at the time, I didn't think I was, but I was pretty socially liberal. Like, I didn't care about all these stuff, but I knew, like, I didn't like the Democrats for whatever reason, you know, and I fell into libertarianism where, you know, it's true that libertarianism kind of like allows this stuff. Mm-hmm. And like, you can justify, like, oh, as long as you're not hurting somebody else, like, who cares what other people do, you know? And that's where, but then you get older, you know, and you're thinking about maybe having a family or, you know, and you start to realize that, oh, actually this stuff that young people are into nowadays is actually really horrible. And it's actually really bad and has major social consequences that I don't think a lot of libertarians were in tune to, or basically just said it was okay the whole time.
Yeah. I think one of the things kind of following up with your point there is that, with kind of the whole, the transforming the kids kind of stuff in a lot of these culture war issues, I think a lot of people kind of looked at that. And when you have people just saying, well, just abolish public schools, you don't really give people a lot of ground, so to speak, right? Because that's not really like a solution right now. And in the podcast I did last week where I discussed why I'm not an anarchist anymore, one of the things I always kind of came back to, and I know this is probably going to sound like a straw man, and there's probably a fair libertarian argument against this, but like, if you can't cover like the age of consent reasonably, or like abortion or something like that, you know, what are you offering to average people when they kind of think about this kind of stuff, or at least people who you think would be most in line with your values? If you're not willing to say you should ban transformative surgeries, and people know what I'm talking about, if you're not willing to say that, like, hey, I am pro-life and my favored position would be, you know, like a total abortion ban, but right now I'd be in favor of kind of like more, maybe something a little bit more moderate just to save the most amount of lives, then like, or, and also like public school stuff, like, hey, maybe banning some certain books isn't that bad. When you just are, when you come from the strict anarchist position, I don't think you have a lot to offer average people, because you can't, nobody's going to want to hear, well, that just shouldn't exist, because it's like, okay, well, what do we do from here? Because now it is there. I think I was, I might've been talking with you guys about this Monday, but I asked somebody who I'm in a group chat with, and this is a good guy. I asked her, or I said that like my wife and I were going to be, she was going to be a cop and I was going to be a public school teacher, and I'm perfectly okay with that. And his reply was, people who share our values, aka libertarian values, wouldn't occupy these institutions. So the follow-up for me is, and I think for any reasonable person is, would you rather have somebody that shares your values in these positions of power, or would you rather have somebody that doesn't? And when you tell people, well, you know, we just can't adopt those institutions because we don't share, or, you know, that's against our values, it's like, okay, well then what's like, what is the scaling plan here? Because I'm not seeing it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very good point. I mean, if your people that would go to bat for you and protect you aren't in those institutions, then you're just seizing that ground to your enemies that will use those institutions against you. And well, I think that's what essentially happened. I think that's what's happening to, that's what's happened with our government now. Like, our enemies have taken over the institutions and are effectively using them against us. And anytime someone that we think like us gets close to power or attempts to get power, there, you know, there's multiple ways they can take them out. Like, nowadays it seems the most effective way, or maybe it's losing power, but the effective way is propaganda. They'll just slander you, call you a Nazi, whatever, and you won't be able to take that position. But yeah, it's a very good point. It's like we're supposed to just expand this, the system is ever expanding and still growing. And, you know, the anarchist solution is like, oh, we're supposed to get away from it. And it's like, okay, well, what does that mean? I have to leave the country? Like, it's still growing. It's still getting bigger. I mean, you know, that's why, you know, like, at least like the Mises Caucus had some sort of offering of like, you know, we're going to try to take over local governments and try to that. And I think there's, you know, there's distant right guys or that are kind of planning to do the same thing, or at least attempting to in certain locations around the country. And honestly, that's probably the best, most effective way to do that. Like, you know, Pete always says it, like, and that's very true, because I'm from, you know, he always says, like, you know, you need a good sheriff. You need a good sheriff that'll take over and be your county sheriff. And that's very true for like small count. I live in Southern Illinois. You know, there's always like weird, progressive, crazy policies that are being passed in our state. And you, if you look, you know, they'll pass some law to the statewide, and pretty much all of the counties with a good sheriff will be like, no, we're not enforcing that. You know, it's like an assault weapon ban. They just had that in like pretty much any state south of Chicago was like, yeah, we're not enforcing that. And it's like, great, you know, I don't have to worry about like a weapons charge or something. And especially with like schools, there's schools around here with that, you know, it's not as popular now, but like the CRT stuff, the like critical race theory stuff that they were trying to teach in school, there were school districts that were outlawing it here. Like, hey, we're not going to teach that. And, you know, there's a, you know, like one small town around here, like had a boy that wanted to be a girl and, you know, wanted to play on the girls' basketball team. And the school board was like, no, we're not doing that. And like whoever's in charge, what is it called?
The principal?
No, above that, the district.
District attorney?
No, not district attorney. I can't remember the name of it, but they're in charge. Basically, and they're in charge of the entire district for that school. And I don't remember what that.
The superintendent?
Yes, that is
okay. The superintendent. It took us a minute, but we got there.
But they were basically complaining that, like, hey, we're now violating state law, and we can be sued now. And the school board was like, we don't care. We're not doing this. And this isn't a blue state, you know. Like this, so like this is. It's not like the perfectly best solution, but this is like holding your ground in these counties that you don't have to, like, this stuff does not have to be injected into your community if you have the right people in the positions. It's small for a small town on a school board, you know. It's not even like it's not a lot. They don't have to, you know, they ain't getting much money doing this. It ain't like a high prestige job, but it's very useful to have people in there that have at least the same ideas or traditions that I do. They're like, yeah, we're just not going to do this. This is crazy.
Yeah. And this kind of always came naturally for me, at least, because before, even when I still consider myself an anarchist, and I did for probably well over 10 years, I kind of think about always, I kind of defaulted a little bit more right leaning. And I almost hate like using the left right paradigm, because to everybody else, it's going to mean something else. You know, I'm not religious, so therefore I'm not right wing enough. I'm not, you know, completely against immigration, so I'm not right wing enough. But like, my perspective always was kind of almost defaulting towards siding with police, which I know to a lot of libertarians is going to make them lose their fucking minds. But like, when I would hear people say all cops are bastards, I'm always like, I don't know, man. I've always had good experiences with police, and I know you've kind of grown up around small towns too. So I'm guessing your experience is probably very similar to mine. But like, I remember in 2020, the story of Ian Smith at Attila's gym, which, funny enough, I've actually been to that gym, and it's actually a really nice gym. But like, the sheriff who stood in front of all those people standing outside the building, telling them, you're defying, you know, the governor's lockdown orders. You're all in violation of, you know, state law, but with that, have a good day, and walking away and not arresting or doing anything. You know, are you telling me that guy's a bastard? Because the guy who's standing down and defying state law because he knows it's the wrong thing to do, I'd much rather have that guy as a cop than somebody who's going to tell you, no, get on the fucking ground and you're getting arrested. Like, I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah, like I would say when I lived, so I had the wonderful experience of living in a big city, which was Phoenix, Arizona, and I completely understood why people did not like the cops, because it was kind of a much different experience with the police in the city from when I grew up here in my small town and small county in Illinois. And, you know, when I was in the city, I was like, dude, these guys do suck. Like, this is crazy. And you know, and when I was in Phoenix, when the lockdowns happened and the cops were enforcing it, and it was crazy. And then I come back to blue state, where we had the wonderful pleasure of Governor Pritzker. And he, like, you know, was the lockdown governor, one of the worst. It was like third behind New York and California and maybe Whitmer. I'm not sure, but they're close. And, you know, the cops down here, the stores, the grocery store, all the places, even the Walmarts here were not, there was no enforcement of this stuff. Like, people walked in anywhere with a mask. So I had, you know, I had Trump as president and a Republican governor in Arizona, but I had a Democratic mayor in Phoenix. But but it was much different when I had a Trump as my president, Pritzker as my governor, and then my mayor in my town was, I mean, I don't even know what he considers himself exactly, but it didn't matter because he was like, yeah, we're not enforcing this stuff. I think, you know, they kind of did the Ron DeSantis at first where they like closed down for the first 2 weeks, but after the 2 weeks, they were like, yeah, we're not really enforcing. They're not like shouting at the rooftops, like, hey, we're defying the orders, you know, like they're not, It's just like everyone kind of went on their business. And restaurants were open everywhere. Bars were open. Like everything was open. Churches were open. Like everything was open around here. No one said anything. And people came to our town because of that. They're like, we wanted to get out of the city because you guys are open. And so, yeah, I think those positions really do matter. And, you know, I never really caught on or why there were some libertarians that would ever say that, like, we should avoid these positions. Like, I thought that was like the most craziest thing. Like, even when I was defined myself as an ANCAP, I still was like, yeah, I'd rather have ANCAPs run the government than, you know, progressives. Like, this is no brainer to me.
Yeah, I agree with your point completely. It always seemed like an exercise in futility to say that, like, okay, well, this kind of stuff exists and, you know, it shouldn't. So therefore, we're just not going to do anything about it. I don't know why people wouldn't want to propagandize, for lack of a better word, or do something, you know. And that was kind of like my perspective when I was going to go be an instructor. It's like, oh, well, I get to be a non-progressive teacher that's going to be able to hopefully share, you know, some relatable experience to kids who are like 12 to 15 years younger than me, but I'm still like close enough to their age that I could relate to them and realize like, oh, you know, I understand housing is a fucking bitch to get into now. Like, I feel you guys' pain. But unfortunately, you know, of course that couldn't happen. So I guess one thing that we should probably touch on is the whole October 7th situation, because I was always anti-funding Israel. And like, I would say even probably 3 or 4 years ago, I just didn't know anything about the issue. I would hear a lot about it, but like, it never clicked as to why it was so important. Like when I started this podcast, I like knew of it. I'm like, oh yeah, we shouldn't be funding that. And I knew that like they didn't treat the Palestinians well, but like before then I just no idea, but couldn't figure out the fascination. And then over time you start to see a little bit more and it's always like, well, why can't we talk about this country here? Like, why do all the Republicans always insist that we have to fund this one country? And we make an exception for them no matter what. We will, you know, scream from the hilltops that we shouldn't fund Ukraine. But as soon as we talk about pulling funding from Israel, there's fucking crickets. October 7th happens. And now I really think the media landscape has kind of changed. And now there's a lot more discourse around this. And I think it raised a lot of questions for people who were relatively agnostic on the issue. I think now there are people who you almost kind of have to pick a side, right? Like you can't really sit this one out anymore because it's so in your face. So before the show, you'd brought up October 7th being one of kind of like the issues, but let's kind of dive in on that a little bit.
Through the conservative like social media rise, I would, you know, like Charlie Kirk, PragerU, Ben Shapiro, like, and, you know, Jordan Peterson, like when I first started getting into all these different ideas, like that was what I first saw, yeah. You know, so I didn't know anything about like what was going on with like foreign policy and stuff. And, you know, like when I was on campus at ASU, like Turning Point was pretty popular on there. And it was, you know, like, it was like a young person's thing to like, okay, like this is like the only place we can go to, because like, so just real quick, ASU, when I went there, it was the first year Donald Trump was president. This is like one of the biggest schools in America. There's like a protest every day, like Black Lives Matter, or, you know, we're walking to class, or, you know, we're marching for feminists, or like whatever. It was like insane. So then Turning Point was the only other one on campus that I was like, okay. Like, they had a lot of like libertarian slogan stuff, like you know, like Second Amendment, taxation is theft, like all this stuff, and it's like, oh, cool. And yeah, you gotta support your Judeo-Christian values. And you know, I would repeat at the time, like, you know, I didn't know shit about Israel, but someone would bring it up, and I would be like, well, you know, it was like, well, it's so corny. What did I say? If the Jews put down their weapons, there would be no Israel. You know, like some bullshit.
Right.
And but what's crazy is I just saw like that's what young people were into when I, at least when I was like at the campus. And then like fast forward like 5, 6, 7, 8 years later, and I was watching like the videos of like a Turning Point event, and it's all like middle-aged women, like moms and like older guys. I'm like, dude, it's like so crazy. And it's like, could you imagine, like, you know, you were in the Turning Point 5, 6 years ago, and then then all of a sudden your mom's like, have you heard of Charlie Kirk? And you're like, mom, shut up. I'm into Hitler now. Like, shut up. You know?
You know? Like, the little mustache man is pretty based, mom. Don't you know?
You're like light years ahead. And it's just, but that's like, that's kind of like, what with October 7th, like I was probably in the same boat as you. Like I didn't really like Israel. I didn't, but I didn't really care too much about Israel in a lot of ways. I didn't think about them. You know, I followed a lot of Scott Horton's foreign policy. I read like his two of his books, so I knew like Israel was a problem. But I just did not like see or like the deep connections that they actually had within our institutions and government. And you know, the invasion in Russia invaded Ukraine. You know, I saw, you know, like when it first happened, clearly like most of the regime like lined up and was like, hey, we have to be against Russia. But you would see like some Republicans that were kind of, you know, hey, let's not send money there. Like, hey, like listen, what we think is going on again in Russia and Ukraine, but there's a problem. You would see kind of the Freedom Caucus in the Republican Party. There were some of them that were actually like stand up, you know, hey, we're not doing this. When October 7th happened, there was none of that. The only one was Thomas Massie. And yes,
our guy.
And when that happened, I watched as this AIPAC, which I got to know very quickly, which I don't even think I knew existed, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I'll be completely honest. I didn't know existed like a year and a half ago. I watched them as they try to slander this man, which didn't mention the Jews, didn't mention anything about Israel. He was like, I just don't believe in foreign aid, just a standard across the board policy. And they tried to slander him. And then I was like, oh my God. And once I saw that, I started to realize like, hey, there's a lot of people that I saw get canceled because of this Israel issue. Right. And I now am interested in what they had to say. And then, you know, I'll be honest too, Pete was actually talking about this kind of like this stuff and influence among that group of people in our country. A little bit before October 7th, and I was like, huh, that's interesting. Like, but I didn't really get where Pete was going with it. Like, I was like, why are you talking about these people? Like, why is you fixated on them? Like, I don't really get it. And it becomes very obvious. At least to me, it was very obvious in October. So I think like within like almost like a month and a half, I was like, oh my God. We have a captured government. We it's bad. It's Zog. Like, yeah, dude, it was like, oh my God, like it is bad. And it was like, I don't know, it was like a crazy like month and a half to like it was pretty much close to like Hitler. I almost got to Hitler post. I never got there, but it was like, dude, I'm almost there. You know, I'm almost there. And I never, but you know, I'm just kidding. But it was like, you know, it was all at once. And it was just like a huge revelation where I was like, oh my God, it matters. Like it actually does matter. Like who's in charge of the government, because their loyalties might not be to this country. It might be, it's not just they're loyal to the corporations. You know, they're not just loyal to the military industrial complex. They are loyal to another country. And that is almost far worse in my opinion.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it was really unsettling for me because, like, I knew of AIPAC and the influence beforehand, but, like, I think October 7th really ripped the mask off where you're like, oh, like you said, I mean, the term is Zog, Zionist Occupied Government. And, yeah. I mean, you say it as a joke, but it's like, when you see they brazenly, AIPAC's Twitter will brazenly talk about, yeah, we just casually spent like $1 million, you know, $20 million on this person's, against this person's primary opponent just to make sure they lost their election. And it's like, man, if this was China or Russia, Democrats and Republicans would be fucking hollering to the roof for good reason too. But like, because it's Israel, we look the other way. And like, I remember some of my friends saying like, oh my God, Matt Gaetz is so base. He's so great. And then like, as soon as October 7th came around, he's saying, oh, we need to call for foreign aid. You know, they're making Jewish students feel uncomfortable. And then I'm like, yeah, you guys were saying he was better than Thomas Massie, but who's the lone wolf out there who is willing to take a stand? And I mean, like, in moments like that, I always just kind of look at Thomas Massie as I'm like, this is our guy. Like, he's the one who's been willing to say, like, no, fuck all you guys. And, like, he doesn't even take, like, an extreme position on Israel either. He pretty much just says, like, you know, I morally support, like, the people of Israel. I don't like what they're doing to the Palestinians, but, like, I morally support the people. And that's enough for them to say, we will ruin you. We will do everything we can to fucking destroy you. And then, you know, Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush and I think it was Rashida Tlaib as well, all got thrown out. And like, you know, granted, I disagree with them on probably like every other issue other than this one. It's just so amazing to me that people don't see that and be like, holy shit, like a foreign government has the ability to do this. And that's the same foreign government that firebombed our troops in 1967. That's the same one who potentially had, you know, information about 9/11. That's the same one who, as soon as Jack Kennedy decided to say, hey, we're going to make you register with FARA, that all of a sudden he ended up with a bullet in his head from somebody named Rubenstein. So, I mean, I'm not trying to say it's all the J's, but I'm saying it's all the J's.
Yeah. Dude, like a big one for me, actually, like this is kind of surprising, was Nina Turner. Now, Nina Turner sucks. She's a progressive. Yes. Like she's terrible in like almost every issue. And she's a big pro-Palestinian person. And she ran for Congress, I believe. And her opponent, like, got ridiculous amounts of funding from AIPAC, like her primary candidate. And it was like an overhaul of money against her opponent. And, you know, like, I don't care. Like, you know, I'm not like sad or anything that Nina Turner lost her election, but it's just crazy that there's like, you know, like why, you know, Nina Turner has all the progressive talking points that they would love, like everything, hates white people, you know, this country's racist, like all of it, open the
reparations,
border. Yeah, open the border, open it wide open, like all this corrupt crap. And but she, this one issue she is not aligned on, and then it's like, oh my God, that is exactly why. And you know, like, yeah, like you said, like, dude, AIPAC straight up bragging about their spending on like 98% of elected officials in Congress are AIPAC supported or something, and you're like, oh my God, dude, they just straight up brag about
It's 98%. Yeah, 90% or 98% of AIPAC approved candidates win their elections. And it's like, that is so telling. And it's always been mind-blowing to me that people don't like point this out more often. And I made this point on Monday's show, and I think I tried to make it on the podcast before, that in 2020, the police were told, who were, funny enough, trained by the IDF, in 2020, the police were told to stand down when whole cities were burning. Mm-hmm. They were purposefully told to not defend private property, which, in I think any reasonable person's estimation, is the function of the police. Mm-hmm. But college protesters get rowdy about a foreign government. They won't even destroy any property. And they sent the military in over people saying Israel's committing genocide. Yeah. I mean, if that doesn't tell you who's, you know, who really matters here, then I don't know what else does. LB Muniz had made this point, and he said, if you're looking for who the government's really concerned of, look whose borders they're protecting. So the point that I made is that Kamala Harris actually is accurately named the border czar. And people would, you know, if I say that out loud without explaining further, people would look at me like I got six heads. But the truth is, she's more worried about Ukraine's borders, Taiwan's borders, and obviously Israel's borders.
Mm-hmm.
More concerned about those borders.
Yeah, she's actually doing exactly what she's supposed to with our
right.
Lowe's knows you've got a job to do, and we help get it done. With the MyLowe's Pro Rewards program, eligible members save more. With volume discounts on qualifying orders through a quote of $2,000 or more. Join for free today. Lowe's, we help you save. Offer can't be combined with any other discount, contract, and or special pricing. Exclusions, more terms, and restrictions apply. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
That's their goal, is just to overhaul the immigration. But yeah, this thing that I'm about to talk about, it made a lot of libertarians uncomfortable. But like, if you like it or not, like, it might not matter to you, like as in like your race, it might not matter to you, it might not matter what you like, your friends or your people around you, that stuff might not matter to you. But that stuff matters to the people in power. That right. stuff really does matter to them. So even if you think like we should live in a world where this stuff doesn't matter, your enemy is operating in a world where this stuff is very important to them. And to like neglect that or just say that's no big deal, I think you're not gonna solve the problem, because people are not gonna wanna listen to you anymore. Like, to pretend this stuff is not happening around us, where, you know, I think at least for like, I mean, I can't speak for everybody else, but like at least for like, you know, white dudes, you can understand why they can go around like, listen, dude, the government hates me. And it's almost a natural thing. It's like, the government hates me, I want to shrink the government. It's almost like a natural tendency for you to be like, yeah, libertarianism makes sense. We got to shrink the government so it doesn't hate me anymore. Like, they're not going to be openly pushing this stuff against me. And it's almost like completely natural to like fall into that libertarianism, because you think that's a solution. It's not only what you believe is a solution for yourself and your people, you also see it as a solution for everybody. It's like a universal thing. Like, so you're like adopting this solution universally for everyone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like it's so crazy too, because all these, like, another thing that really like hit me with libertarians is like, dude, white dudes were getting shit on for years. Like, there's literally policies in place to keep out white people in certain institutions, to replace them. Hollywood makes fun of us. They, you know, like, Jamie Foxx went on SNL, and when he was talking about like, Django Unchained, he literally said that he was happy he gets to, like, I get to kill white people. What's not fun about that? I was like, dude, I mean, I know it's a trope now. Like, if you say, like, if the roles were reversed, the entire system would freak out on you.
Right.
And then when you start noticing these things, so then you're on Twitter and you just shoot out a shit post that can be seen as racist or whatever. And then like all these libertarians get mad and you're like, dude, like, it's like, look at the world we live in, man. There's institutions against me simply because of my race. And you're mad because of a fucking tweet. Because someone said the N-word on Twitter. Like, this is what upsets you, because someone calls out the J's on Twitter. Now you're mad? Dude, have you been seeing the world around us? Like they can say this anywhere. And you, like, no one freaks out about it. Like, a lot of libertarians didn't freak out. It was like, oh, that stuff doesn't matter. But when it's like a minority, it's like, in a lot of ways, they're like, a lot of libertarians had leftist tendencies as well. And it took me a long time to realize that.
Right. One other thing that I think kind of ties into what you're talking about there pretty well is the whole immigration conversation, where I think when you start kind of getting to the whole race and IQ stuff, for me, once again, this stuff kind of came naturally, because my progression was going from Stefan Molyneux and a lot more like more right wing people. But a lot of libertarians, despite, you know, that if they didn't kind of come in from that perspective, they were always like, oh, well, all cultures are the same. We can import people from anywhere. Open borders are fine. You know, you're restricting people's movements and stuff like that. But then, you know, in today's world, you're kind of looking at the situation that we have now. And it's like, okay, well, when you dump tens of thousands of people into towns that are just of a completely different culture, and you're bringing cultures that don't understand what America's like here, you can't just say like, oh, that's fine. It's not good, because like people didn't vote for this. People don't support this. Mm-hmm. These people don't have the same say on, you know, a fraction of land that, like, let's say we do. And I think Dave Smith, I think, has laid out the best, you know, closed borders libertarian position. And that's, you know, we as Americans who have lived here for a long period of time, paid taxes, and, you know, kind of put into the system, so to speak, we should have a greater say in what happens in our public commons than people who don't. I mean, I don't see how that's a controversial statement. I've had libertarians argue this with me, but it's like, are you out of your fucking mind? Like, people who don't pay taxes and like don't live here and don't have any stake in the culture and society writ large, why should those people receive benefits from something that they're not contributing towards? I think it's a very reasonable standard to say that, like, if you're not contributing and you don't have any kind of stake in, you know, the betterment of the country, then why should you receive benefits? Because then you're a parasite. And that doesn't just go for brown, black, or whatever. That goes for anybody that really comes here and isn't, you know, they come here and they use the public resources when they haven't contributed anything.
Yeah, I completely agree. And this is like, you know, like, it's kind of crazy because it's like something that needs to be retaught again when this was like standard, you know, this was the standard thinking a long time ago. Like, but this needs to be retaught again. And there's a lot of people, and especially, you know, libertarians, where they've just they don't view us as a country or as a people. They view this as like literally an economic zone. And
right.
And that's all it is. Like, borders don't exist. Countries don't exist. The people in here are just widgets that we can trade out because, you know, well, they serve the market better. They can hire cheaper labor. So it's fine. Like, well, maybe if you would work for less money, then maybe these corporations would hire you, or maybe start your own corporation or something crazy, you know, like it's, it took me quite a while to, cause you know, libertarianism, a lot of it is based on, you know, economics, and that's how you should, a lot of it is like how you view the world. And, you know, when you try to explain to people, like, I like talking about like the Great Migration, right? This is when they took black people, like ex-slaves from the South, and they migrated them north. And a lot of that was done systematically for corporations to hire cheaper labor in these cities. And well, you know, these cities, when they had all these people from the South that have a different culture than the people from the North, they came into the city, and yeah, you could look at the city and be like, wow, the economics got better, like the standard of living got better. But there was massive cultural differences and like aggression that happened within the groups. And like that was a problem. And in the end of it, a lot of these cities, a lot of the people that were there before left. It's literally called white flight. They literally left. They new people came and they got kicked out basically, or left on their own. And it's kind of ridiculous that like the same thing is kind of happening with migration from the South, and people just see it as like, okay, well, you know, they're hard workers and they're doing jobs that Americans won't do. And there might be even truth to that, but you're still replacing people and just basically telling these people tough, like, hey, these new people got here that aren't from here. A lot of them don't even speak the language. They have no stake in this country. They don't know what the ideas are, the culture is. And you're just accepting them and effectively okay with replacing the people that have been here for generations. It's kind of insane to me.
Yeah, and that kind of goes to the whole cultural thing. Red Hawk had a comment, free markets only work in closed borders and with white people. I don't know that I'm necessarily there, but I think there's definitely something to that. And this kind of goes to the point that we were talking about earlier, where not all people want to be free, not all people should be free, and not all people can be free. When you have, let's say you want to, kind of have this more libertarian society. Yeah, Kyle, you definitely should check out the episodes I did with Red Hawk. If you don't know who Red Hawk is, I'm sincerely surprised that you don't. I think you two would get along great, and you should definitely check him out. And like I said, check out the episodes I did with him, because Red Hawk is just Red Hawk's that fucking guy. But, I'm sorry, it's a little bit of a side tangent, but if you would want to have a libertarian society, you're going to have a high degree of trust. And I do think that you kind of have to reject degeneracy. And I do think that requires closed borders and respect for those borders. And even beyond that, boundaries, right? And this goes beyond like political stuff. This is more like social stuff where you have to be willing to say no, because what is an open border? An open border is saying yes. Right. And I know this sounds very simplified and stupid, but an open border is telling people, yes, you can come in. Right. But a closed border and telling people no, that takes, you kind of have to have zero empathy, so to speak. Right. You have to be willing to stand firm and say that you're in your place, that you're standing on your values, and you're not going to let people come across here who you don't think are capable of assimilation, or just that you don't want them here. Right. And we would accept this in our own houses. So why wouldn't we accept this on a larger level? I don't see how this isn't a logical extension. So I don't know, just like when I see libertarians saying that like closed borders is a non-libertarian position, I don't think that's entirely right. But I mean, if it's not a libertarian position, then I'm okay with that, because I think we should be able to say like, I don't want people here who aren't welcome. And I'm, like I said, I'm not the, you know, complete immigration restrictionist. I mean, I know plenty of, I know one person off the top of my head, personally very well, who immigrated here and I think deserves to be here because he's worked his ass off. He paid in the system, has kids, and has a stake in the betterment of the country. People like that, okay, we could have a conversation there. But like right now, what we're doing is clearly unsustainable. And libertarians who don't see this, it's always been mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, it's very true. And well, like that's why like the universalism of libertarian is something that does need to be in question, because, it's like, what are rights? And people, like people want to, like they try to pinpoint these down, but like rights are essentially just a concept that came from a culture. Like it's not a real thing. Rights are not. They're not real, you know, they're not like, there's no atoms that make up a right. It's literally a made up concept.
It's a social construct.
Yeah. It came from a certain culture, and this culture, like that, if that culture changes, then those rights go away. Aaron McIntyre, I think on his show, I don't know if it was his, what he explained in his book recently, or if it was something that he got from someone else and he was just explaining it, but I got it from his show is what I'm saying. But he basically explains that like the concept, like the whole concept, like libertarians kind of understood this, so the Constitution is kind of like null and void. But he explained that the Constitution is more like it was a stamp in history. Like this is what the people at that time believed. And this is what they believe in the time. So it's like easier for, because everyone around at that time understood this, or at least had a concept of it. And this is what was granted to them. But, you know, this was Anglo-Americans. These were English people, and they decided this. And they were all deeply religious Christians. You know, they were Protestants, but still had faith. And, you know, over time, you know, once you import a bunch of Irish Catholics and Italian Catholics and Germans, you know, that concept might be easier for these people to adopt because they do come from Europe. But over time, there's going to be differences and they're not going to fully accept them, and it's going to change. But then you start talking about bringing people from like literally the third world where there's no concept of these rights exist. And you bring them here and we're supposed to believe like, well, they have rights just like we do because the Constitution or because they're universal, but they have no concept of this. They don't even believe in that. And so when you demographically change the country, it's going to change the culture, or it's at least going to change major friction within the culture, because not everyone believes in the same thing or has the basic same understanding. Like, it's easy to explain to libertarians and be like, hey, when we tried to give democracy to Afghanistan, Afghanistan rejected it. Like they were just like, yeah, this is weird. This is stupid. Right. We're not doing this. But when you, like, then you'd say, like, okay, so what happens when you bring those people from Afghanistan here? They're going to reject it. They think it's stupid. They don't understand it, or it's just not in them to get it. So, like, why would you think that bringing them here is going to work?
Right. And much your position on rights, it's, I've explained this before. I'm still agnostic, but I've had so many conversations with people who are very, very, very knowledgeable in religion. And Kyle's probably going to, I don't know if he'll hate me by the end of this or if he'll agree with me, but like, I do agree that like rights are a social construct. And I don't think this is entirely like a bad thing. Like, we don't know how to form a society in that's prosperous without religion, which generally kind of is the backbone of rights, right? Where, you know, we do have a Christian culture, right? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where our founding is that basically, you know, the founders were white Anglo-Saxon Christians or whatever the hell they were. But they all kind of had these ideas and they decided that, like, hey, we can form a prosperous nation based on these ideas. And everybody agrees that we can have a prosperous nation with these ideas until obviously like the progressive era, where now this started to change, where people kind of are trying to go back to the founding and saying that, like, oh, well, this is flawed. But it's like, okay, well, you don't really know what you're fucking with here, because we created the most prosperous society that the world has ever seen because of these values. And it's, I don't know how wise it is to say we should just throw these away, but really, it's not necessarily the rights. It's the idea that we all agree that we are going to use force to maintain these rights and maintain this civilization. And now we're starting to do away with that. And we're kind of seeing how that's working out for us and it's not very good. So, you know, I do believe though, that like all morality is subjective, including divine command, but divine command at least is based upon something that people, who are religious believe is never changing, which is God. I do not have, and I've never heard a secular person explain a better way to form a society based on secularism than, you know, versus Christian values and basing your civilization around those values. So could you have a secular society that's peaceful? If it was maybe high IQ people who all have the same understanding and same culture, maybe. But, you know, I guess this goes to the larger point, and maybe, you know, kind of continuing on from the libertarian to dissident right pipeline, you do kind of realize that like a lot of these values that we have and that we share do come from religion, and a lot of that stuff is kind of pre-enlightenment.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, it truly is like what America is going through. I mean, I could be wrong. I know a little bit about history, but I might not know enough to say this outright, but this is probably the first time in history that you're watching the home population of a country's identity being completely wiped out and demonized. You're watching their entire religious beliefs being completely demonized and pushed out of every institution and government. And then while simultaneously trying to spread your beliefs, whatever that is, across the world and import the entire world. I don't know if this has ever happened before, but this is like literally insane. Because you're basically turning, the government is turning outward and expanding while also turning inward and attacking the population that literally built this country. Like it's pretty crazy to me. And I never, at least I don't know if something like this had ever happened before, but I do not, you know, I'm pretty black-pilled on America as a whole. And when I mean the whole, I mean, I think there's places in this country that can be saved or safe, but as a whole, as like our entire nation, I just don't, like, unless something changes, I don't know what that'll be. Sure, maybe it'll be Trump, not sure, but I don't see it turn around for us, as at least as a nation as a whole, is how, because I don't think this has ever been done before. And it's not even just happening in America, it's also happening in Europe. Frankly, it's particular to European Christian nations that this is happening to. But yeah, I don't know how that'll turn out. And, you know, it's, and America is unique in a way because the founders did basically open the door for all European Christians, which at the time was pretty progressive and liberal, like kind of insane. at the time, because they're just opening the door like, hey, any white European Christian, you can come here to America, where, you know, English had England, Spanish had Spain, Germans had Germany, Russians had Russia. And, you know, that is their historic homeland. And that, you know, that should be theirs. There's a huge argument that that should be theirs. Like, what's happening to England is actually crazy. It's been in English people's hands for centuries. I don't even know exactly how long. And it's being taken over and taken from them. It's crazy that that's happening. And in America, like, you know, we're a newer country and it was built by European Christians and it was open for European Christians. But I don't know, like we've had waves and waves of immigrants for a very long time in this country. And it's not to say that like the immigration that's happening now and the people they're letting in should be tolerated. It's just like, I think we're just a different case than these other European countries.
Yeah. It is very interesting because as time goes on, as technology becomes more and more accommodating, you do see people on a large scale tend to get more and more progressive. And I don't know how you fix that. Like, I don't think we go back. People always talk about a pendulum. There is no pendulum. You go forward with technology, with the advancement, and kind of figure it out from there. And with the global sexual marketplace, when it comes to women and then like immigration and people's knowledge of other areas, I don't know what the world looks like in, you know, 10 years, 15 years, 50 years. I don't know what kind of world my kids are going to have. My grandkids, I definitely don't know what kind of world they're going to have. It's like an open-ended question, but you know, when you have people, I don't know if there's ever been like a time where, you know, cultures just kind of hodgepodge, went wherever they wanted to go in any time in history. I don't think there really has been. So we're kind of running a worldwide experiment and we don't know how it's going to end. Right now, it doesn't look good. Could it get better? Maybe. I don't know. I don't see it getting better, but there's so many questions. I don't think anybody knows how it plays out. But right now, by the looks of things, you know, it just doesn't look good.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's really interesting too. I don't know exactly why this is. I haven't found a good answer for this, but what's very strange to me is a lot of ex-Soviet countries, like countries that went through the brutal totalitarianism of communism, they have a more nationalistic, ethnic, like religious based societies out of communism. They came out of communism, the Berlin Wall came down and the Soviet Union fell. And those countries, at least to me, seem to have a very much better understanding of who they are as a people, their faith and borders and nationalism than any country in the Western, in the West, that any European country in the West. And I'm not really sure exactly why that is, but it's very interesting to me that like, you know, like Poland and Hungary get a lot of shit from the United Nations all the time. It's like, why aren't you letting Muslims in? You know, like, and they're like, we are Polish and Christian. We don't let Muslims in. Like, this is just not what we do. And, you know, I don't know much about them, but that just from the outside looking in, that's like, seems like you have these at least more more nationalist characters that at least are respectful to their people's religion and at least respectful to their heritage. And like, you know, a lot of people learned that, like, you know, Putin knows a lot about Russian history. And like, you know, I don't know what our politicians know about history of America. And it's kind of crazy that, you know, these countries that were ex-communists seem to have a better understanding of who they are than almost any country in the West. And that does seem to be at least changing. It seems like a lot of like white identity is on the rise. Like and you're seeing people being much more proud to be white, and like especially the younger generation, probably our generation and younger, is really like at least somewhat trying to bring that back. At least what I see, it looks like the Zoomers, and I don't know. It's just really interesting. I don't know why it ended up like this for the West.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I'm glad you brought up the whole situation with Putin. I remember watching that and honestly being kind of mesmerized. And obviously Putin's a bad guy with, I don't need to throw out the standard progressive caveats, but like to see somebody that can competently, at least seemingly competently, lay out the history of their country in an interview format, in just like where we don't have leaders like that here in the West. Like I know everybody says like Idiocracy was supposed to be a movie, not a documentary, but like, it's like you look at something like that and like to ask any of our leaders to go into some kind of in-depth, any topic really. I wouldn't expect that out of any of them, to be completely honest with you. So like, where is that kind of love for country, if you will? Jeff Dice had the quote that, you know, people care about, what is it, blood and soil, and libertarians forget about this at their own peril. I think that's true. I think people want to know that their country is something to be proud of. And like, you know, I have a American flag partially tattooed on one of the letters on my back. And that's because like, I look at our founding and what the, you know, the US had kind of brought about into the world and think that's a very, very good thing. Like the spirit and the myth behind the United States is great, but like what we are today is such a far cry from that, that, you know, now we kind of depend on our own spheres to kind of remind us of the potential that could be. So maybe this is where I depart with you and being blackpilled. Like I'm just like by my nature, a very optimistic person and generally like a happy person. I think that we're going to be fine because we have a very prosperous people and that we have a very capable people as well. Yeah, say whatever you will about Putin, but I know he's pro-Russian. Can we say that about most of our politicians? Exactly. You don't get the feeling that like our politicians get elected and say like, this is fucking America and we're going to do what we do best. Like we're not just a economic zone, as J.D. Vance, much to his credit, and I put him in the thumbnail because I think he's kind of like the unspoken leader of the dissent right now. Right. He never claimed that mantle, but I think he's kind of like that guy for people, so to speak. But like, he specifically said like, this is a nation, this isn't an economic zone. And that's an important distinction that not a lot of people picked up on.
Yeah, that's like a huge, and it's actually kind of funny because I saw a clip and it was Ben Shapiro and he's like, I don't really know what he's getting at there. That doesn't really make sense to me. And it's like,
Of course you don't.
It wouldn't make sense to you, Ben. Yeah, it wouldn't make sense to you. And, but yeah, dude, I agree. Like, I think, you know, I recently, you know, I did a little ancestry, you know, and I found out I had like German immigrants that came here and, you know, like a big portion of whites in America were come from German ancestry, but you don't really see like, you know, there's people that are proud to be Irish. There's people that are proud to be Italians. There's, you don't really see it anymore, maybe because we separated and had a war with them or maybe for other reasons. But there's not a lot of people that are like proud to be like, oh, I'm English. I come from England, you know, but you don't really see there be a lot of people proud with being German. And, you know, I haven't done enough research on this yet, but just from the stuff I have seen, it seems like there is like some sort of social engineering that takes place in this country where they specifically can almost whitewash or propagandize or demonize groups of people in this country. And it almost effectively works to make them completely forget about where they come from and their language. Like a long time ago here in Illinois, a lot of the roads and signs and stuff, it was in German. And a lot of people around here spoke German. And all that's pretty much gone. Like, I don't think there's anyone around here that speaks German. There's no more German signs. And World War One, I think, played a huge effect on this because we went to war with Germany. But I really think it took really into effect was World War Two, as when, you know, the big Nazis bad and, you know, they can't have anything. And then, you know, it's quite funny, dude, but a lot of Germans were questioned about their dual loyalty at the time, about if they're loyal to, you know, Germany or not. And a lot of them got accused of it that have been here for like 3-4 generations, which I don't know. Maybe they were. Maybe there was truth to it. I don't know enough about the topic yet. But yeah, it's pretty interesting that I do think there is, I don't really fully understand it, but some mechanisms in this country that really denigrate certain people's histories and customs and religion even. And I think it works. I think it really does work on the population where they will almost not even forget about these cultures, but outright spite them and demonize them themselves, like as the generations get older, and they will outright reject them and even campaign against them, outright against them. And I think, I don't know exactly why or how that stuff works, but it seems to work really well in this country for whatever reason. And you would think, like communist countries, you would think like this stuff would work almost better in a way, because you know, it's just much more brutally enforced there. Like what they did to the religious leaders there and what they did to the people to put them down, on at first glance, you would think this would work better in like getting the type of people that you want out of this population. But it seems to me that it works much better here in the more persuasive or propaganda, or I don't know exactly how it works and the mechanisms, but a lot of people here has completely forgotten their history and where they come from and why their ancestors, like why they were the way they were and why they believed the way they did. And it's, oh yeah. I mean, I saw it all the time in college where just white people would be like, you know, my grandparents are racist and, you know, they're old school Christians and they don't understand the new world and I hate them, blah, blah, blah. Like, this is insane, dude. I would never say that about my grandparents.
Yeah, I think the Germany point is, I've been listening through Pat Buchanan's book, Churchill, Hitler and the Unnecessary War. There's something really unique about Germany in this respect. And yeah, I think Red Hawk's right. The Nazification came home. There was German newspapers in America until the 1940s. It was almost like Germany was really like the bullied country. And I don't know enough about world history to really know exactly why that is. I have some suspicions, and I think he would probably agree with said suspicions. But when you think about it, it's like, man, the Treaty of Versailles, and then like a lot of the stuff that was imposed upon Germany leading up to World War II, and then how Winston Churchill just consistently wanted there to be no off-ramp, specifically for Germany. It really makes you question, like, why was Germany the one that was so heavily put upon? And then, of course, you know, after, you know, the mustache man rose and took over, then they really became the villain. And I think this goes back to the old idea of the founding myth of World War II being a load-bearing myth for America, where, you know, you can't question that, because that's what really kind of upholds a lot of our ethos today, is that the Nazis in World War II was the worst thing that ever happened. And honestly, the World War II probably was the worst thing that ever happened in human history. But all that responsibility goes on Germany. Yeah. It doesn't go to anybody else, when really, in my understanding, very, very shallow understanding of the reading of World War II, it does belong on Churchill. Because who do you blame? The person that retaliates and did some undoubtedly horrible shit, or the people who refused to give these people a chance to de-escalate? In my opinion, the people who refuse to take an off-ramp and kind of, you know, cool things down, I think that's the chief villain. So I think it's reasonable to say that Churchill was the chief villain of World War II when you look at it from that perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is. Yeah. I think you're right. I don't, it's especially when it's hard for you to claim that you're the good guys when you side with Stalin. You know, I always didn't make any sense to me, that we're like, whatever, you can think whatever you want about the Nazis, whatever, but you know, like what the, like before the Nazis even took power, there were death camps in the Soviet Union. Like there were straight up death camps. They were killing plenty of people. And, you know, that was like almost completely, you know, left out in American newspaper. Actually, Michael Malas talks about this. This is one thing that I learned from him, was how almost Western media was complicit with what was going on in the Soviet Union. Like they were basically lying about it. I can't remember his name, Walter Duranty, I think his name is. He was called the the Times man in Moscow or something like that. And he was the voice from Moscow, and he would like basically completely lie for the Russians and everything that was going on for the Soviets. And but when it came to so when it came to Stalin, everything was, you know, played down, or this is an over exaggeration, like it's not that bad. There's some problems and they're working through it, but it's not that bad. When it was horrible. And but what everything that was going on in Germany was the worst thing ever. It was the complete, like, it was the end of the world. This has to stop now. This is insane. It can't happen like this. And, you know, it's just really interesting. Like, before the war even started, before the Nazis took power, this was like, there was already this prejudice in our country toward the Soviet Union. And, you know, I don't understand exactly the connections there. Some people might say it's the little hats. A lot of people point stuff out that. Yeah. That might be true. I'm not exactly sure. I don't know enough about it. But you're right that, you know, it was already kind of decided that they were going to go to war with Germany. Like, they, you know, they, like, it was predetermined that they wanted to go to war. They just needed an excuse on how to do it. And I don't, like, you know, when effectively Germany won, but like, you can kind of think, and that's kind of hard because the whole war like goes another, like, you know, it goes like, it's like 6 years total. But once he took over France, and the war was kind of over, there was nothing British could do. I mean, they can continue bombing them, and they did, and they bombed civilian infrastructure. Like, the British did it first. They bombed them multiple times before Hitler even responded to bomb a city in England. Like, he was like, please don't do this. Like, you know, suing for peace over and over, because he effectively won already. Like, it was already over, and he kept dragging it out and dragging it out. And that, I think they wanted to get U.S. involved, and that was they were trying to do everything they could to figure out a way for the U.S. to get involved in that war. And yeah, so like, he just drug out a war that he effectively lost. There was really nothing he could do to respond, and kept it going until eventually they could get someone else involved, which the U.S. eventually did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we've been going for Jesus almost an hour and a half now. So I think that's probably a good place to kind of put a nice little bow tie on this. But I want to ask you before we rock and roll, where would you say you were, let's say, in 2019 politically, and where would you say you are now?
So 2019 is when I started my podcast. So I would probably say I would consider myself either an ANCAP or pretty much almost an ANCAP. Like, I don't remember, at some point around there, I probably said I was an ANCAP. Now I don't really know. I don't even know what to define myself. I don't really care about ideologies anymore in a lot of ways. Like, I would probably say I am right wing. I have adopted a lot more of their perspective on things. I probably align, like you said, with like OGC guys in the dissident right. Like Pete, like, to be honest, Pete's been a big influence me in this path. It took me a while, but you know, when he turned on libertarians, I almost took that personally in a weird way. I was like, you bastard, you know. And then but no, like, Pete's had a huge influence on me. I mean, I was listening to him when before he became like the post-libertarian thing. So I'm not exactly sure, but you know, I consider myself right wing, and I just want to do what's best for like my family and the people here in my community. And like, I don't try to get out, you know, like, yeah, I care about this country and I want everyone to do well in my country, but I don't really try to think outside my community here anymore. I just think like, hey, we got to do what's best for the people here, and whatever that is, I want to do. And you know, I obviously, like, I love talking about geopolitics and stuff, and I think that stuff is very important, that stuff matters. But when it comes to like the people around here, that's what I care about most. I can't focus on everyone all at once.
Yeah, I think that's understandable. Yeah, I've said before I'm more of like a dissident right libertarian because I don't think I'm ready to give up the label libertarian. I understand the branding has mostly been tarnished, but you know, I would say pretty much I'm a minarchist at this point because I do think there's justifiable uses.
Yeah, once Space became the nominee, I was like, yeah, I'm done, dude. I'm done.
That's reasonable. But I kind of look at it as like there are necessary functions of the state to you know, stop abortion, you know, age of consent, like the fact that people debate that, or even like police and stuff like that. Pretty much a lot of libertarian answers generally do kind of come down to a roundabout way of having a government. So like, well, why don't we just kind of call the spade a spade and say, hey, you're pretty much going to have it no matter what. So if we have one, why don't we kind of have one that like represents us and is as little as possible and does all the basic functions that we would need it and prefer that it does. So yeah, I think that's kind of where I'm at as well, which I'm guessing you're probably not far off from that perspective either.
Yeah, I wouldn't, I don't, like I said, I'm kind of like almost starting from scratch in a lot of ways again. Like I'm rethinking a lot of my old ways of thinking, but it's definitely like the borders and maybe more racial things I've fallen into a little bit more now, but I just think that those stuff actually are much more important than I even considered before, when I kind of just thought like, oh, it doesn't matter. We're all individuals and your culture doesn't matter. We can all, you know, work in this free market economy. And then, you know, it just clearly like going to college and being in the city, being, you know, it's less like, you know, I used to, you know, what's really funny is like, you know, I used to give my parents crap and be like, wow, you guys just need to hang out with like minorities more often. You like, it's fine. Like it's not a big deal. They're fine. And then I realized like my parents weren't like the way they are because they didn't spend any time around minorities. I found out that they're the way they are because they have. And, you know, like, and I kind of had to go through that myself to realize like, oh, there is some serious differences here and some good. And, but we also have to acknowledge the bad as well. And, you know, and there's a reality to that. And a lot of people don't want to face that.
Yeah, it makes some people uncomfortable to talk about race. And it's funny because I do have a lot of friends who are more black that I'm just really good friends with. But I mean, we can talk about this kind of stuff. You can't talk about this kind of stuff, then okay.
Yeah, exactly.
when you realize you were judging them by the car. Well, you know what? I think you and I would probably agree on this, but I just wanted to touch on it real quick because it just came to my mind as soon as Red Hawk commented on that. The whole body camera thing of that. What the hell was her name? Stacey Wilson, Tracy Wilson, whatever the fuck her name was.
Sydney Wilson.
Sydney Wilson. There you go. That Asian cop, like that dude was incredibly graceful. Like I kind of understand not firing as soon as she opens the door because like somebody comes to my door and I don't know who they are and they're yelling. I'd be a little skeptical too. So like, okay, fair enough. But then like once she starts charging you, like if you point your gun at her, and you say stop, and she takes one step forward with the knife still raised, you're done.
Yeah.
I don't care who you are. Yeah, you are well within your right to let him go. And that dude did, he was way too kind to her. And there's still people losing their mind about that stuff. I'm like, that is like case closed. If that was your sister that was like pulling the trigger, you'd be like, hell yeah, get him, sis. If that was my wife, I would be like, yeah. Yeah. No. Like first step that fucking bitch takes at you, you're getting put down. And just so everybody knows, if you ever want to come to Vandegrift and find out where I live, my wife carries more than I do. Right? Just to let you know, she has more guns than I do. And she carries more often than I do. So if anybody wants to fuck around and find out, you're more than welcome to. We're as friendly as could be, but if you want to start shit, there won't be shit. So
Yeah, but it was crazy, man. I thought the cop was more than gracious. Like, way. I was like, dude, I almost found myself getting anxiety while watching the video. I was like, dude, just shoot, dude.
Yeah, like, he's like, back up. I'm like, you gave her like three? I would gave her one and then let her, you know, say, all right, sorry, you had your chance.
Seriously.
Yeah, Jesus Christ. The dude let his face get all fucked up over that shit. So, Jesus Christ. All right, Typo, this is a enjoyable conversation as it always is. And it was kind of sparked by our post-show conversation on Five Till Midnight. So everybody, make sure you go check out Five Till Midnight, Typo. Where can everybody check you out and all that good stuff?
So I got a podcast with Luke, Biting the Bullet. We haven't recorded some episodes recently, but we keep saying it, but we seriously should be putting out a new episode soon. So it's on all podcatchers. You can go check that out. And then obviously I'm on a show with Kyle here, Five Till Midnight. So go check us out there. It's a lot of fun. We talk about random stuff and just try to have fun while doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And make sure you go follow him at the Real Typo on Twitter, right?
Yes, sir.
Nice. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Typo, if you got anything else, we'll close her out there.
No, just thanks for having me on, man. It was good talk.
Of course, for sure. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, take care.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.